courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand?
You hold my hand!
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUS Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot, editor of the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal. And today on this edition of Potomac Watch, we have a special guest, Roy Teixeira. He's a man of some note in the political world, well-regarded analyst, political scientist, and author. I think it's fair to say, and he could dispute this if he wants, that he's a man of the center-left, but he is now affiliated with the center-right American Enterprise Institute. He's the author of several books, most notably The Coming Democratic Majority in 2002, which predicted with co-author John Judis a new period of ascendancy for the Democratic Party that appeared for a while to have arrived with the election of Barack Obama in 2008. But has not turned out to be durable. And he has now written a book that it will be forthcoming with Mr. Judis, assessing what's happened over those 20 years since the last book to the Democratic Party in American politics. And I think he also writes on occasion for the Liberal Patriot on Substack. And it's fair to say his analysis of our current political events differs from a lot of the conventional wisdom. So here at the outset of the presidential election, it's a very good time to talk to him to get an idea of where we stand politically. So welcome. We're really nice to have you here. Appreciate it.
Delighted to be here, Paul. Should be a fun conversation.
So let's just not duck the issue du jour, which is, of course, will Donald Trump be indicted by the Manhattan District Attorney, Alvin Bragg, for his mishandling of hush money payments to his alleged mistress? Nobody knows if he's going to be indicted or not. It's been widely mooted in the press. But what I wanted to ask you is, what is the impact of this politically on Trump, his campaign, and our politics, if in fact he is indicted on this charge?
Well, I don't really know. And I don't think anybody knows. I guess I would lean on the side of it's not going to make as much difference as people think. I think people will go to their respective corners on this. And I think that Trump sympathizers may think this will rev up his base so much, it'll make him an unstoppable force. But I rather doubt that. Conversely, I mean, people who think on the Democratic side that this will injure him because this is such an awful thing to be indicted for, that a lot of people who are on the fence will suddenly decide I could never vote for Trump under any circumstances. I think that's baloney as well. So, I mean, I don't know. I guess I lean toward it's a bit of a tempest in a teapot, but hey, I could be wrong about that.
Well, it obviously could not. I mean, there are other prosecutorial risks for Trump, the Georgia grand jury, and also the special counsel, Jack Smith. So this could not be the end of it. But this is, for American politics, the crossing of at least one Rubicon, which is that we've never had an ex-president, former president, indicted, much less having that same president running for office. And what I worry about is it's opening something of a Pandora's box in our politics, that it's crossing a norm that hasn't been crossed before. And it will not be the last time we end up with some local prosecutor. And next time it may very well be a Republican prosecutor, because we know how partisan some of these people can be, trying to make a name for himself or herself by indicting a Democrat, either a candidate or a former president.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with that, Paul. I do think it's most unwise in many ways. And it does establish a norm that could be even worse for our politics and other things that have happened recent past. So, yeah, I mean, this clearly is a case that did not need to be brought. It's clearly driven to some extent by Alvin Bragg's particular political needs and inclinations. And I don't think it's a healthy thing for democracy writ large, leaving aside whatever partisan implications there may or may not be. I'm not enthusiastic about this at all. But, you know, I don't have any control over it either.
Yeah, well, you and me both. Though we tried to weigh in and suggest that maybe Mr. Bragg should think better of it for a whole variety of reasons, one of which is it's not sure that certainly he wins in court on this case. We have to
absolutely
see the evidence.
Not. It's pretty weak. So, yeah.
And that would make things even worse. So let me ask you one more question about the Republican coalition, because obviously it's been roiled by the victory of Donald Trump. First of all, getting the nomination, breaking through the so-called Republican establishment, such as it was and is, which isn't all that much, and taking the White House and then now running again. But did Donald Trump make permanent changes to the Republican coalition? And how durable will those changes be if Trump himself leaves the scene, either because he is defeated for the Republican nomination or the White House in 2024?
Well, I mean, I think it's incontrovertible that Trump did reorient the Republican Party in a more working class populist direction. That's where he got his additional votes, was from working class people, initially from whites, but we saw actually in 2020, increasingly from non-whites. He struck a populist tone. He denounced trade deals. He denounced the elites. He denounced the establishment. And this was really in the wheelhouse of a lot of voters out there who weren't hearing what they wanted to hear from the Republican Party, even though they weren't hearing what they liked from the Democratic Party either. So there was a clear lane there for someone within the Republican Party to start breaking the crockery and saying, you know, this is baloney. You're getting screwed. These trade deals suck. But believe me, I won't trust Social Security and Medicare unlike those other awful Republicans. So I think he has changed the party. And I think everyone in the party is now trying to negotiate those changes and figure out, with Trump on the scene, how do I deal with those changes? And even if he left the scene, how would I deal with those changes? Because I don't think there's any going back to the previously existing Republican coalition.
Is this a Republican coalition that's more akin to what it was in the 1920s or in the late 19th century?
I absolutely think you can make that argument. Yes, I think there's some similarities, and they're interesting similarities. But does the currently existing Republican Party have the political smarts to actually take advantage of that to the maximum extent? I think that's really unclear. And partly that's because of this sort of extremely unusual figure of Trump, who's a guy who has incredible street smarts about how to appeal to certain sectors of the electorate, but is not, shall we say, the most astute overall political judgment. And he's a little bit erratic. I think that's fair to say as well.
Delicately put, for understatement. Yeah, he had, in my view, proven he just wasn't capable of governing on any consistent basis that could do what Reagan did, which was to put together a new majority coalition, which is going to be a problem if he gets the nomination or if by some chance he wins again in 2024. Let's turn to the Democrats, because the conventional wisdom, certainly among most of the press corps, is that they are sitting in the dominant position going into 2024. They have the incumbent in the White House, obviously Joe Biden, even though he's in the low 40s to mid 40s, depending on the poll you choose with job approval. He looks like he won't have an opponent of note in the primary. That is always an advantage. And of course, he may end up running against a Republican Party that may have Donald Trump at the top of the ticket, who he's already beaten. But I know you're somewhat more skeptical of where the Democrats are, and you think that they have to address some problems. So I guess the first question, you've written this new book, what did happen to that emerging Democratic majority?
Ooh, big question. And it is, in fact, the topic of our new book, which will come out in November. You can pre-order on Amazon now, called Where Have All the Democrats Gone? And our basic argument is that the Democrats had an opportunity in the early 2000s to build on some of these emerging demographic, economic, and ideological trends that we thought, on balance, favored the Democrats. And if they stuck to a path of progressive centrism and were able to keep a very substantial share of their working class, white working class support, the political math would work out in their favor, given, you know, overall, it didn't mean they win every election, but
sure,
they would have an advantage. And that seemed like in 2008, maybe that was emerging. Very quickly, there was the hammer blow of 2010. You know, Obama comes back and wins in 2012, which is kind of an interesting cut point for the Democrats, because I think if you look closely at the data from the 2012 election, basically Obama won that election in the upper Midwest by a sort of populist appeal to people around the auto bailout and against Mitt Romney. But that lesson was completely forgotten, which brings us to how the emerging Democratic majority's thesis was completely bowdlerized into demographics are destiny. The rising American electorate will conquer all. And that's what happened in 2012. And, you know, we're in the catbird seat. Well, that's completely wrong. That's not exactly why they won the election. In fact, there was a lot of moving parts there. And one key part wasn't able to claw back white working class support from their 2010 nadir. And then you come to 2016, Hillary Clinton is like a poster child for elitist college educated Democrats. She runs against Trump, who hammers her on all the issues that I was alluding to earlier. And they completely underestimate how much defection they might have from white working class voters in various parts of the country, particularly Midwest. That does in fact obtain, and she loses the election despite carrying the popular vote. Once again, you know, our argument is that lesson gets misinterpreted. They're not understanding why these voters have moved away from the Democrats. Many people feel the Democrats have betrayed them economically and that their communities have suffered under decades of the kind of economic policies the Democrats became identified with, which we might loosely call neoliberalism, which is one blow. And then secondly, they see the Democratic Party moving in this quite aggressively and indeed culturally radical direction on a lot of issues. And this particularly becomes, this was obviously part of 2016, and things don't get any better for the Democrats after that. They become even more culturally radical and even more enthralled to the liberal views of the white college educated voters in particular, who start to dominate the party more and more and define its image. And then you get Joe Biden kind of coming to the rescue in 2020 as kind of Mr. Normie. But all of the pathologies that are undercutting the Democrats' appeal to working class voters remain. And that is a fundamental problem the Democrats have. They are not a party whose basic outlook on the world and culture and attitudes appeal to many, many, many working class voters in the United States. And given that it's supposed to be a working class, a party of the working class, that's kind of a problem. You're competitive, even with losing working class voters, provided you dominate the college educated vote enough. But that's a precarious position to be in. And that's the situation they are in. And our analysis suggests that the Democrats have to go back to the future, become the party of the common man and woman, of the ordinary American, the party of the people. Right now, they don't seem to a lot of voters to be the party of the people, and that's a big problem.
The irony here is, to my mind, at least one of them, is that in nominating Joe Biden in 2020, an awful lot of Democrats thought they were voting for something other than the kind of the left culture salient you described in the party, because obviously the black voters who carried the day in South Carolina for Biden weren't particularly woke. These were middle-class stalwarts of the Democratic Party. And yet, Joe Biden himself, in winning the nomination and governing, has adopted many of the left's cultural priorities. How do you explain that? Did he have to do that?
No, I don't think he had to do that, but clearly he did do that. I mean, now he's trying to walk some things back to the center, right, with upholding the override of the DC crime bill, talking about being tougher at the border and detaining immigrant families who cross illegally, you know, allowing the Willow Project for oil to go forward. I mean, these are all moves back toward the center, but the fact of the matter is, as you're saying, Paul, I mean, most of the administration, and it's certainly its sort of image, its persona, its emphases were all pretty much in line with what the left wing of the party was pushing, particularly in cultural issues. Why did he do that? I think that he's a man of the party and he feels like that's where the energy and the push is coming from. He's sensitive to what people say in the media. He's sensitive to what the activists say. He's staffed up with a lot of people who are far to his left on all these issues. So you even get on something as sort of incendiary in a way as so-called gender-affirming care, he's been completely, totally down the line with the sort of the radical trans activists on this stuff, right? He doesn't have to do that. I mean, if you look at the public opinion data, I mean, people don't want these folks discriminated against. On the other hand, they're pretty nervous about kids getting puberty blockers and hormones and eventually surgery and being transitioned at school without the permission of their parents, without even telling their parents, or, you know, teaching gender ideology and gender fluidity to people who are 7 years old. None of this is very popular, but there's been no line whatsoever drawn on that. And I might add on a lot of other things as well. And now he's scrambling back to the center because he recognizes these things are vulnerabilities. So, you know, we'll see about the trans stuff in particular, which is a very interesting issue, how it's sort of taken over the Democratic Party apparatus. But I think he recognizes there's a bit of a problem. But I do think that Biden is not a profile in courage. He's a man of the Democratic Party, and he puts his finger to the wind, and he moves in the direction, and he feels the wind blowing. And the wind blowing around him was moving in that direction. So I think even though his instincts, you know, as so-called Scranton Joe or whatever, are sort of more moderate. You know, he wants to be with the kids, right? He doesn't want to be the stale old grandpa. Hey, I get this stuff, you know. Wow, this is cool. You know, let's go for it. But I think it's been a big mistake. I think if he governed more as the normie guy he is and tried to make the Democrats into the normie voter party and move it in the direction of some of the commitments he put forward in the campaign, but not too far, and sort of tried to walk back some of this culturally radical stuff, I think he would have had a pretty, you know, more successful presidency, I think, than he's had. Again, the argument of Democrats is, well, look at all this cool stuff he passed. This is great. I'm not so sure that, you know, so you were alluding to this earlier, Paul, they're in such a great position going into 2024, despite having passed a passel of legislation.
All right, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, more with Roy Teixeira about the Democratic Party coalition and its issues when we come back.
Courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand.
You hold my hand.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker. Play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast. That is, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot here on Potomac Watch with Roy Teixeira, the political scientist and author. And we're talking about the Democratic majority that didn't happen and where that party stands now. It's fascinating because when you think about successful presidential candidates, most of them, certainly the two-termers, put a stamp on their party. They lead it in a certain direction. Trump put a stamp on the Republicans, as you suggested. Reagan put a stamp on Republicans. George W. Bush put a stamp on Republicans with his compassionate conservative themes. And then Barack Obama certainly put a different stamp than Bill Clinton had on the Democratic Party, though Clinton, of course, with his new Democratic themes, did the same with the Democrats. Biden, as president, seems to have done that less than any president I can think of, and he has done so by he's become the party. It's as if he said to the party, you tell me what you want me to be, and I will be that. And then he hired Ron Klain, his chief of staff, and Susan Rice and some others to say, tell me where the party is, and I will go there. And that's what's defined his administration in so many ways.
Sure. I think that's exactly correct. As you point out, successful presidents, they put a stamp on their party. I think with him, it's the reverse. The party put a stamp on him. So I think that's partly how we've arrived where we have, where the Democrats have not been able to remedy, really, a lot of the fundamental weaknesses the party's coalition has. And they're just sort of like moving forward. As Biden put it so eloquently after the 2022 election, when asked what he would think that Democrats should change to appeal to voters, he said nothing. Absolutely nothing. The more they know about what we do, the more they like us. So, yeah, I mean, I think he's in a way, he's a prisoner of the party. And I think that is an interesting and unusual situation. And maybe you could argue that given the dynamics in the Democratic Party, maybe that was the best they could hope for. You know, someone who would be a prisoner of the party, but have a sort of normie voter. I think of him as a designated normie of the Democratic Party.
Well, you talk about three ways in which the Democrats need to change to address some of these issues. One is they need to really address the woke cultural salient in the party that has defined in trans issues and equity versus equal opportunity, so on. You talk about the need for a policy of abundance, which relate not strictly of redistribution. And you say they need to embrace a politics of patriotism again. I don't think you're saying that Democrats are unpatriotic, but you're saying they can often sound like it to a lot of Americans, I guess. So the woke cultural issues in particular, what do they need to do to address those and make those less alienating to many voters?
Well, in my view, I mean, that has a number of components, but one, for example, is around crime. You know, Democrats should seek to emulate the great Tony Blair, tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime. Doesn't mean you give up on trying to deal with some underlying causes or pathologies or whatever, but you make it very clear, we're going to get the criminals off the streets. We're 100% for public safety, and we're going to do what it takes to make places safe and orderly. That's something they haven't done. It's something they should do. Biden's failure to override that, veto the override of the D.C. crime bill was an indication that he kind of started to get that. In immigration, people want border security. They don't think the border should be essentially uncontrolled. They know people are gaming the asylum system. They know a lot of people want to come here and they can't all come here. Democrats have to start making it clear that, in fact, they are going to secure the border. That's a good thing. And they're going to figure out a better system, an efficient system for deciding who can get in or not. And they're going to tighten up the asylum requirements or system because it is being gamed by people. And just basically, I mean, in a way, I think a lot of this stuff is just common sense. It's common sense criminals have to be got off the street. It's common sense you need cops. It's common sense the border can't be open or even quasi-open and you have to enforce border security. And illegal immigrants are, in fact, illegal. And they're not just undocumented, they're illegal.
You realize that you can't even say in the word illegal when it replies to immigrants in much of the Twitter universe without being called a racist.
Yeah, yeah, I know, exactly. I mean, it's, why do you think I left the Center for American Progress? Because you couldn't really have conversations about a lot of this stuff. And right. You know, there was a lot of language policing. John and I actually talk about exactly that development. We all have a whole chapter in our book on immigration. And one thing we touch on is just the weird changes in language that took place. So yeah, you can't say a lot of this stuff, but my view is you got to start saying this stuff. The Democrats need the equivalent of sister soldier moments in some of this stuff, right? Where they call out excessive radicalism in some of these areas and maybe name some names about who stands for what, and that we have a different position. We Democrats are for securing the border. We don't think that people who come over the border illegally are sort of not criminally liable in some ways. I mean, they are illegal. I mean, that is. So I think standing up against that sort of euphemistic language policing is key. I think the Democrats need to make it clear that all this language policing on gender ideology and race is not good, and that the whole ideology, in fact, is not what Democrats stand for. Democrats, as you alluded to this earlier, Paul, they stand for equal opportunity, not equal outcomes. Mm-hmm. And Democrats do not think that America is a society born in slavery, marinated in racism, and a white supremacist society this very day. They do not think that. They reject that. They do not think all white people are guilty of white privilege and are complicit in an oppressive system that keeps the masses of black and brown people down. I mean, I think that stuff has to be rejected. It's divisive. It doesn't ultimately even help, of course. The black and Latino poor people are the ones who really need help. Because the Democrats need a strong coalition to be able to provide, push the programs they think might actually benefit them. And it doesn't really work to divide people along these lines. I mean, there's a lot of political science research that shows if you frame things in universalist terms as opposed to race-specific terms, you generate more support for your policies. So I think they need to move to the center on all those things. And I think one thing that's related to this, Paul, and that we talk about this in our book as well, is climate. Mm-hmm. I think climate has become a cultural issue. The median liberal Democrat is convinced that, you know, the planet is roasting and there's almost nothing too radical that we could do in terms of moving forward. We have the sort of clean wind and solar as quickly as possible. Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. And the fact of the matter is climate is a much more salient issue for those kinds of voters who dominate a lot of sectors of the Democratic Party than it is for a median working class voter who is much more concerned about other things. And who is going to be very sensitive as we proceed along whatever energy transition we do, the availability of cheap, reliable, and abundant energy, right? I mean, that's what people want. And there's a lot of, there's a very sound argument that, in fact, it's going to take a long time to have a clean energy transition. And the natural gas is going to be with us for a long time as a bridge fuel. And that we should have more nuclear. And the idea you could run an industrial economy completely off of wind and solar is ludicrous. I mean, anyway, end of rant. But I do think that's become a cultural thing. It's something that people believe deeply in certain sectors of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, that's the shift that I think has been so notable to me. Because, I mean, if you deal in the rational world of analysis of energy, just energy policy, prices, cost, delivery, accessibility, you see very quickly that solar and wind cannot simply provide, they can't power an industrial economy. They simply can't. Why? Well, because the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow and battery technology does not exist now that can store it and therefore power it when those things don't happen.
But Paul, it will if we wish it. If we wish those batteries to exist, they will. They will happen.
I don't know how many editorials I have written, my staff has written on these points. And you look at what's happened when you have blackouts in certain areas because fossil fuels go out and you can't provide the energy you need. You look at the future of where energy supplies are coming from, and you're going to need fossil fuels. You're going to need natural gas. You're going to need oil well into not nearly 2050, but I think the Chevron CEO the other day said 2100, right?
Right, right.
And even though that might be a self-interest argument, nonetheless, I think most reasonable analysts think that that's kind of true. But it doesn't matter. These arguments. It doesn't matter because it becomes a question of faith. And that gets to your point that this is really a cultural issue. It's an identity politics issue. It's who I am as a voter. And that's very hard to overcome if you're a political leader.
True. And again, this is where Biden, the party, is putting its stamp on him rather than the reverse.
Do you think that the Democrats feel that as long as Trump's a nominee, they're in pretty good shape in 2024?
Yes, that's definitely my impression that, in fact, they would be completely delighted if Trump is the nominee. And right. If they can figure out ways to increase the probability that would be the case, they will certainly do it. They think Trump is a sitting duck. And I think it's a reasonable case to be made that, in fact, he would be relatively easy for the Democrats to beat. I'm not so sure he would automatically lose, keep in mind. I mean, be careful what you wish for. I mean, if Trump is a nominee, what if he actually wins? It could happen, man. I mean, it's not out of the question. And then Katie bar the door. So I think it's very unwise of Democrats to count on this, and they should be careful about that. I mean, I do think other candidates for the Republicans would be harder for the Democrats to beat, but I do think they're a bit complacent about the idea, oh, Trump's going to be the nominee. Oh, we can beat him. No problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is their view, and much of their actions suggest that they want to keep him in the spotlight as much as possible. And
absolutely. They love it.
One of the big questions is, will the Republican primary electorate exercise the judgment to say, you know what, when you look at all of this evidence and the evidence of certainly the 2018, 2020, 2022 elections, maybe we should go in a different direction. We'll see if, in fact, they do that. Roy Teixeira, thank you so much for coming on. This was an enjoyable conversation. Instructive, certainly, for me, and I hope for our listeners, and I hope to be able to have you back here, particularly when you're in your new book comes out.
Oh, wow. We'd love to do it.
All right. Thanks so much. And thanks to all of our listeners. We're back every day here on Potomac Watch. Thanks for listening.